We've gone through chapter two, and as we mentioned, chapter two is addressed to the church members and their conduct in church services. So Paul is laying these things out for.
You have to record it.
Excuse me, I have to record this. So Dennis Braley, I think his
recording in progress.
There we go. Dennis Braley's power went out, so he asked that I would record it. So it's recording, so we'll have that saved for Dennis so that he can upload the study to the website. So anyway, Paul, getting back to 1 Timothy, Paul was seeking to prepare Timothy to take on the pastoring the church in Ephesus. So as in doing so, he's going over basic principles. So he's talked about church services, which are important. He's talked, which he does in chapter two. He's talked about various things that he needs to be aware of in regard to the truth and teaching the truth and making sure that the congregation is focused on those truths. And he's responsible for all of that. The next thing that Paul moves on to is the subject of the ministry. So in 1 Timothy chapter 3, you have a beautiful exposition of what God expects as far as the ministry is concerned. As you look at that, he's talking about principles that you would be looking for in individuals who are going to serve in the church. If they were going to serve as a minister, as an elder, if they're going to serve as a deacon, or they're going to, ladies that are going to serve as a deaconess, then you would look at these particular qualities, and the goal would be, as you look at these qualities, that in the person that you're considering ordaining, you would see these qualities manifesting themselves. So that as by their conduct, by their service to the church, the members would see these qualities, and as a minister, Timothy would see these qualities, and then he would be able to make a wise choice and enlist people who are going to help him administer the church in Ephesus. So we're going to look at, first of all, some things to consider in regard to the ministry and the qualities that are described here. And as you look at, and this is just an overview, and then we'll get into 1 Timothy 3, beginning in verse 1, and go through the scriptures and see what they have to tell us. As you look at the ministry, it had its origins in the service of the priests and Levites. So as you go back to the Old Testament and you look at the system that God set up, the people that were the leaders in the nation of Israel, at least on the religious side, were the individuals who were serving in the priesthood. So you had the priest and the Levites, and that was the way it was in the Old Testament. And it sets a basic standard, but when you look at what took place in the New Testament, God is not just carrying on the priesthood with the priest and the Levites. It's a completely new system. The New Testament ministry is not just a revised version of the priesthood. In fact, a minister is not a priest. A priest is a different office, and because for you to be a priest, it's based on the fact that you're related to Levi. And so the descendants of Levi made up the priesthood. The individuals who would serve as priest and the high priest, they were all related to the high priest, and it went from one high priest to the next. And so it was based on who you were related to. But that's not the way it is in the New Testament ministry at all. And as you look in the Old Testament, you know, you only have the Levites, and you had to be descended from Levi before you would ever be designated to work in the ministry. In the New Testament, we realize the physical lineage is unimportant. It's not something we judge when we make a decision to ordain somebody, an elder. We don't do that because it's not important. It's not what Christ inspired, the path that Christ inspired the church to take. The qualities that are important are the qualities that are laid out in 1 Timothy 3 that we'll talk about later. So there are qualities of character that are the guidelines for how you would make a choice of somebody to serve in the ministry. It would have to do with their character as opposed to who they're related to. So who you're related to should be completely unimportant, and it should be based upon the qualities that you are showing as a member of the church. And so anyway, as you look at somebody that you're going to consider to be an elder in the church, then you're going to look for these qualities, and you're going to see if the qualities are being manifested in their service to the church. And what's a beautiful part of that is if the person is manifesting those qualities, then other people would make note of that. And so if you were to ask the brethren, you know, like what we would do is we ordained back in Ohio when we served there, Liz and I would make an assessment and look at who we might consider ordaining. And then we would ask for input from the congregation. Who would you see as someone that should be ordained? And so we would put some paper out and slips of paper and a box, and you would make your input, whatever you thought, and put it in the box, and then we would look at it. And interestingly, almost every time the brethren in the congregation would see the same thing we did. And so basically they would verify that this is a person that we recognize as members of the church as serving the congregation, because they stood out in that particular way. And as a result of that, then we would feel confident in ordaining them. I know that we, you know, sometimes they would see something that we didn't, which is a good thing. But if you go back to Acts chapter 6, you see the ordination of deacons. And what was happening is the one men who became apostles, they had certain responsibilities that they were to carry out as ministers in the church, serving the congregation in spiritual matters. However, there were a lot of physical things that needed to be done. And as a result of that, they became bogged down in those physical things. In fact, they occupied such a large amount of their time that they were not able to serve the brethren effectively on the spiritual front. So they eventually came to recognize, hey, we can't do all of this, both the physical responsibilities of widows and people that have needs, and take care of the spiritual responsibilities that we have. So they decided, I think God inspired them, just as God opened Moses's mind to listen to his father-in-law, Jethro, who told him, you know, Moses, you're trying to do everything yourself, and there is no way you're going to be able to keep this up. You're going to burn out. So you need to find men who are displaying quality of character and designate those men to help you take on those responsibilities in the congregation of Israel. So he began to look for those qualities of character, and then set those people apart to be in charge of various groupings in the nation of Israel. And so there's the same principle that the apostles came to apply, where they saw that they needed to have individuals who would be serving the congregation. These are individuals who would be deacons, and they would take on more of the physical responsibilities and needs of the congregation. And then the elder, the overseer, as it's called, they would take care of other parts of the congregation. And between the two, the deacons and the elders, they would serve the spiritual and physical needs of the congregation. So as you look at the, you know, God inspired the Paul to write down various qualifications that are essential to somebody who is going to serve in the ministry. He doesn't give us a complete listing. I mean, it's not exhaustive, but he gives you the essential elements of a person who is going to serve in the ministry. And why are these qualities essential to a minister? Why are they so important for someone who's going to be ordained? They're going to be looking at this individual and seeing if those particular qualities are clearly visible. A few reasons for that. One of the reasons why you want a person with those characteristics is because the minister tends to be the most visible representative of the church. And being such a representative, then in that individual who is representing the church, you want somebody who is known for having very, very high standards of integrity, and those qualities would be observable not only to members in the church, but members in the community as well. Also, when you look at the qualities that you're to look for in somebody that's going to serve in the ministry, is that they're to lead by example. They're to lead by example. So the congregation is going to look to the people who have been set apart as leaders, as deacons and elders. They're going to look to them and see how they're conducting themselves. And hopefully they're seeing those qualities manifested in their lives, and it sets an example for them. Oh, this is how I'm to live. This is how I'm to deal with that. And they're to be setting a good example that the rest of the membership can follow. Doesn't mean that they're going to be perfect, but when the members look at them, they should have qualities that do stand out. But they should have a certain level of effort that's clear in their lives, and a certain level of accomplishment in becoming more Christ-like, and they stand out in that regard, and the brethren can look to them as an example and somebody that they can safely follow. I know just one thing. When there was in 1995, there was a question about which way we should go, what should we believe, and how should we sort this out. It was interesting that the brethren looked at those people who were ordained, and they were looking to see which direction they went. And as a result of that, then they may not have understood every facet of what was going on, but they were looking to the ordained to set the pace for them and give them a direction to go. I know that, and so that's just the way it is. They look to those individuals who have been designated as leaders, and that's where they should look. They should be the ones who are setting a godly standard that the members can follow. And the members should also be following that godly standard. But it is a good thing when you have individuals in the congregation who are exercising that degree of leadership that the brethren can look to. So as you look at individuals who are you're considering ordaining for to an office, you do have people that would like to be ordained, and and some people really desperately want to be ordained. But the question is, do they manifest the qualities of character that Paul talks about? You have people that want to be ordained. They look at it's an office. It carries a certain amount of prestige, and they would like to hold that office. But the question is, are they qualified? Because if you choose to ordain somebody who's not qualified, that's not going to help them or the congregation. So you want to really try to make sure that they're in it for the right reason and that they're going to rightly serve the congregation. I know one of the terms that they've used is that somebody has a pastor's heart. That means that they are like a shepherd who loves the brethren and is willing to serve and sacrifice for the brethren, and just as Christ, who is the shepherd of the congregation of Israel and the shepherd of the church, he was the one who set us the example, and he's the one that we look to as far as the approach that we take. So as you look at the list here found here in 1 Timothy chapter 3, what it does is it gives us a criteria by which we can judge, is a person living up to the standard that Paul was inspired to write down, so that we can evaluate, are they living up to the standard that Christ would be pleased with? So it gives you a criteria by which you can make a judgment as far as whether you're going to ordain somebody. So in the ordinations that I have done, I've tried to look at the criteria that Paul lays out here in 1 Timothy 3 to talk to the individual that I might be considering to ordain about these particular principles, and try to see if there are principles that I can observe in the individual's life and therefore feel confident in ordaining the person. Some of the qualities listed here, for example, as you look at one of the qualities there, it says that the individual that you're going to ordain as an elder, they should be apt to teach. And as an example, not everybody in the congregation is apt to teach. People have different talents and abilities and strengths and weaknesses, and not everybody is apt to teach. Not everybody is a good teacher. So that doesn't mean they're unworthy in some way. No, they just have abilities in a different area, and somebody else may be strong in the area of an ability to teach. And so if somebody is not apt to teach, then they may be able to be a very faithful deacon. They may even serve as an elder, but they don't feel comfortable speaking. That's not their strength. But they can serve the brethren. They can anoint, and they can take care of other issues that people face and serve the congregation that way. But as you look at the issue of teaching, not everybody has that gift. And so if you're looking at an elder, that would be something that you would look for, because they're going to help the pastor of the church in serving the congregation in that way. Most of the qualities that we find here in 1 Timothy regarding deacons and elders are qualities that all Christians should have. So you may think, well, that just applies to those who are going to serve as ordained members of the congregation, either as elders or deacons. No, they apply to all of us. If you have those qualities as a part of your life, they're being manifested in your life, then you're going to be an asset to the congregation. You may not be ordained. You don't have to be ordained. But if you're manifesting those qualities that Paul is talking about, then you're going to be an asset to the congregation, and you are going to help that congregation greatly. So the New Testament ministry is first and foremost most an office of service. And those given the opportunity to serve in the capacity must have and maintain a certain level of spiritual skills and abilities in order to fulfill that service. So it's they are to be servants. They are to be walking humbly before God, and their lives are to be dedicated to the service of the church. And the way that they conduct their individual and private lives is important to that whole process. So let's go ahead and begin in 1 Timothy chapter 3. Let's begin in verse 1. 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 1. There it says, this is a faithful saying. If a man desires, that is, this person has his heart wrapped up in this, they're passionate about it. If a man desires the office, the position of a bishop or the office of a bishop, he deserves a good work, or he desires a good work. So as you look at, they call it bishop, and we've never used that terminology in my experience. We've always referred to them as elders. But if you look at the word there that's translated bishop, it means overseer, somebody that's given the responsibility to oversee the congregation. So overseer would be another word that you could use. And so chapter three gets into the character of those who qualify to be appointed to preside over the worship services and the congregation. And these are qualities that aren't just found in America or in Europe. They're qualities that are to be found in the church in regard to elders wherever you go. Wherever the church is at, these are the qualities that we're to be found in those who would serve in the ministry. So if you went to Botswana, if somebody was an elder, those are the qualities you should find in that elder. If you went to Madagascar, or you went to wherever else in the world, the Philippines, the elders would have these qualities, and you would look for them, and they would be consistent qualities that are found in the ministry of the church. One thing that's interesting that stands out in my looking at this particular subject is when I went to Ambassador College. I went there and I had no interest whatsoever in being a minister. I didn't really know what that was all about. And so we're having orientation and Mr. Armstrong is speaking. So he's speaking, and then he asked a question. He said, how many of you want to be ministers? So I, being new in the church and being suspicious, thought, don't raise your hand. This is going to go badly if you raise your hand. So I had no idea, but this one guy raised his hand while he kind of got hammered. You're just vain and egotistical, and you'll never be a minister. And I thought, whoa, I'm glad I didn't raise my hand. But, that was kind of, maybe appropriate to the time, but it was more or less kind of harsh. So anyway, later on, the church has come to understand that if there is somebody that would like to be an elder, then that's not necessarily a bad thing. You know, if you are seeking to be an elder and everything that you are doing is to impress the minister and basically prove that you should be ordained because that's what you really want, that's not the right approach. And what God's looking for is people who would like to serve in the ministry, possibly, or to serve as a deacon, or to serve the church generally. They're not seeking an office, but they've got the mindset more or less that, God, if you can use me in an office in the church, then use me. And if it's not your will that I would be of use in that particular area, does that prohibit you from being of service to the church? It doesn't. You can still serve in the church without an office. So you do the best you can to serve in the church in whatever capacity that you can. And if you have the qualities that would lend to your being an elder or your being a deacon or your being a deaconess, then as you are serving, that's going to stand out. And if it's God's will that you serve in that office, then God is going to lead the leadership of the church to see it and to see, I think that this is a person that we could ordain, and then we could begin pursuing it. So it's something that you don't earn. You're not going to do it by trying to impress anybody. And unfortunately, you know, when we first came in the church in the 1970s, you would see various individuals who were really pursuing reaching the becoming a minister or a deacon or whatever it may have been, and that was something we had to learn and mature in, and then hopefully take a more mature approach to it. So it's something that if somebody aspires to be an elder or a deacon or serve the church in a greater way, my recommendation would be continue to serve, but you don't have to be ordained ever. You continue to serve, and if it's God's will that you would be exalted, who do you rely on to be exalted? You ask God to lead the whole process, and if it's his will, then I'm happy to be of service to the church. So it's something that you would pursue serving the church, and if it's God's will, then you're more than willing to serve in that way. So let's go, and so that's verse 1. And as you look at the individuals who were elders, one of the words that's used for elders, as I said, is the Greek word episkopos, and that's the word translated bishop. But there's another word that is translated as an elder, and that is presbyteros. And presbyteros is a word that means elders. And so these two words were used interchangeably. Episkopos, presbyteros, they were both used interchangeably up until about the 3rd century. We don't really use the word presbyteros. We are probably all familiar with the fact that there is a Protestant group called Presbyterians, and that's based on that particular usage of the word for leaders in the church, and traces back to that. And so when you look at a few verses like Acts chapter 20:17 and 28, it uses both words in those two, in that passage, where you can see that they're both used and they're almost used in an interchangeable way. So anyway, as an individual becomes an overseer, a servant in the church, their primary duty and responsibility is to love and care for the flock of God. And so Timothy then goes on and he begins to look at other qualities that are important to the ministry. And so he goes through these qualities, and they're all qualities that are important to us as members, as well as to members who are individuals who are going to serve in the ministry. So the first thing that Paul points out as he's speaking to Timothy is this: a bishop then must be blameless. So what does it mean to be blameless? Well, does it mean that you are sinless and you never sin? That's not what it means. When it says it refers to being blameless, it's talking about the individual would be an individual against whom you could not bring an accusation. So there's no outstanding charge that you could direct toward this individual. Does it mean he's perfect? It doesn't. But there is no charge that you could bring against the individual that's obvious to anyone in the church to where they could bring it forward and make an accusation. So he's to be blameless. That is, he's to have the qualities and integrity that is crucial to serving as a leader in the church of God. And as Paul's, as he's looking at this quality of being blameless, seeking for individuals who are going to be consistent with Paul's approach, Paul's apostleship, and ministry under Christ, who is Lord, as he must reign until he puts all enemies under his feet. And that reign in earthly terms is particularly through his body, the church. So Christ is the head of the church, and Christ is ruling in the church through the leaders that he has established. And he will use those leaders in order to effectively serve the church and preserve and care for it. And that's a heavy responsibility to take on. So should everybody be an elder? I don't think so. Some people don't feel comfortable with that. And it's a lot of weight to carry sometimes with some of the things that you have to deal with. So as he's talking about those people that he wants to serve, he's to be, as I said, a bishop should be blameless, a person of stellar character and free from provable black marks against his character. And so Paul is not talking about somebody that's sinless, but somebody that is clearly a person of high character. And as you look at Jesus Christ, Christ was probably the most blameless individual that ever lived. And you could bring no accusation against him because he was perfect. But human beings are not, but they should have a high standard for integrity and honesty and the qualities that you would be looking for in a ministry, in a minister. The second thing that Paul brings up is a bishop then must be the husband of one wife. So the Greek here, as you look at what it says, is explicit that the overseer is male, because that male individual is going to be the husband, which is a male responsibility of one wife. So he's not going to have a harem. He's not going to be a bigamist. He's going to have one wife. So he's married his female wife to whom he is fully and exclusively dedicated. So he's to have a high standard as far as his a relationship with his spouse. And an overseer doesn't necessarily have to be married, but if he is going to be married, he's married and dedicated to his wife and lives up to the standard that Christ has given as far as a husband and wife, you know, that he is to love his wife and to cherish her and to honor her, and his wife is to reciprocate and carry out the qualities that Paul talked about in the book of Ephesians. And if he's an overseer and he is not married, then he is to be, as the term is used in the commentary I was looking at, as celibate. That means he's not having affairs or involved in any sort of activities with the opposite sex that would be inappropriate for a single man. So anyway, this was a something that was to be common among the leadership in the church. It was in Paul's time and is still in our time. He's to be the husband of one wife. And as you look at the way things were in the Roman world, the Greek world that existed then, people were notoriously immoral, and sexual immorality was just a common part of society, part of religion, in fact, and it was something that was all around the people of the church. But Paul said, that's the world, and we're coming out of the world and living in a completely different way. Paul then moves on to another quality that is expected of a person who's going to serve as an elder. He must be temperate. And temperate can mean somebody who is free from alcohol or drug misuse. And an elder should regard his calling and duties with sobriety rather than taking them as something that he really doesn't take seriously, and should demonstrate self-control rather than impulsiveness or lack of concentration or distracted behavior. So he's going to be a person who is self-controlled, somebody who's temperate. And, you know, in the past in the church, I've not seen that so much in recent times, but in the past in the church, there were various people that were in the ministry that did have a problem with alcohol. And alcohol is something that's part of our world, and it's not sin to take a drink, but sometimes people were too much involved in drinking, which is not appropriate for a Christian. You know, for instance, the priest in ancient times in ancient Israel, they were not to drink when they were on duty as a priest. They were not to drink because when you drink, you don't do the job properly. You don't do the job properly. So for us in the church, you know, we are to be careful about drinking. Drinking and getting drunk and that kind of thing is inappropriate for Christians, and most assuredly inappropriate for a minister. So we're to drink in moderation, and we don't have a couple of shots before we get up and start speaking. That would be completely inappropriate. And so he says that we are to be temperate, we are to demonstrate self-control, and avoid any kind of impulsiveness or lack of focus on the job. We're to take it, you know, we're to be fun. It's not that we're just to be a bunch of sober, unpleasant individuals. It's that we're to be balanced and be under control in the way that we live. It says in the next point that Paul brings out, he says, and again, a bishop then must be sober-minded. And again, this is speaking of being self-controlled. Pastoral leaders should know their own minds and not be flighty or unstable. One writer speaks of this word in light of decision-making. Men who make important decisions about the ministry of the church must be prudent and to control their appetite. So they're under control, so they can look at the facts, they can listen carefully, and then they can make a good judgment that's going to be of benefit to the congregation. So you want individuals who are sober-minded and they're able to make good judgments, because on you hangs the congregation. You know, are you over-drinking? Are you making poor decisions? They're looking to you. They're looking to you and the way that you handle the job of overseeing the congregation. So it's a very important responsibility that an individual has. And you've got to think about all of those things in the way that you deal with the brethren of the church. And you've got to, you know, seek to, you know, stay close to God so that you can be self-controlled and make good decisions that are going to benefit the congregation and set a good example for them. You know, you want to be an example to the congregation in regard to your marriage relationship. And those are all things that you have to keep in mind as you look at somebody you're going to ordain, or you're looking at yourself. Am I living up to these standards? 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 2 again goes on to speak about a bishop, somebody that is going to hold that office, must be of good behavior. And he means by that he's to be respectable. He's with respect to the ministry. It refers to having characteristics or qualities that evoke admiration or delight so that a person is held in high regard. So Paul wants overseers whose characteristic actions cause them to be held in high esteem. So they're wise, they make good decisions, they're somebody that you could think highly of, and you could hold them in high regard and look to them as a good example. And that's what you want, is for somebody of that quality who would the congregation would look to and follow their course of living, their course of action. Paul moves on to saying a bishop then must be hospitable. A bishop must be hospitable, and that is to show hospitality to other believers, to show it to, and as they do so, basically, they're showing hospitality to Jesus Christ himself. And as an elder or a leader in the church, a deacon or an elder, then you are to be hospitable, to be able to, if you have the opportunity to invite people into your home or to enjoy a meal at a restaurant with other members, you're hospitable, you invite them out. Or if you are, I know what we've tried to do is, coming to my house in Rosenberg is a long way for a lot of people. So we've actually met for lunch at the church hall, gotten there early, and then had lunch with somebody to get better acquainted with them, because it's a long trip for some just to come to services, and then to go on down to Rosenberg is really too much to ask, especially in light of the gas prices and Houston traffic and all of that. So you try to find ways that you can be hospitable, and your desire in being hospitable is to enter into a situation for positive fellowship where you can get together with other members and you can talk and you can eat. And eating and talking has always been a big part of the Church of God. It was a big part of the Church of God in the time of the apostles, and it still is. It always has been. So as those individuals who you're considering to take on the office of a deacon or an overseer, you want those individuals who are hospitable and welcoming to others, they're reaching out to them and joining together with them in eating a meal possibly. So it's something that is well worth doing, and that hospitality should be an example to the brethren. He's inviting people to eat. He's inviting people to stay after, to get there early and join in a meal together, or to stay afterward, or to, and that's why, being involved in things like, the potlucks and things like that, why stay? Well, it's part of being a member of the congregation, and it's a part of entering into fellowship and building relationships. So as an elder, a person you're going to have as an elder, then you're going to be a person who leads in that particular way. You're hospitable. You're happy to welcome people to your home, and you're happy to find creative ways, if necessary, in order to interact with the brethren. So it's well worth taking the time to do that, because that's how you get to know one another and build relationships, which is essential for somebody who's going to be a leader in the church. The next issue is found in chapter 3, verse 2, is a bishop then must be able to teach. And we've touched on this a little bit. So this person who's going to be a leader is going to be a person who can understand the truths of God and take the truths of God and expound them. He can teach them and share them with the brethren. So if brethren have a question, he's able to answer it. He's able to teach them about it, explain it to them in a way that they could understand. So a person who would be an elder would be someone who is apt to teach. As you look at the church, one of the primary responsibilities that the church had was to share the gospel with other people. They were to go out and preach the gospel and share the truth with other people. So it would only make sense that if that's what you're doing, you're going to the world and teaching them the truths, that you would be skilled and able to teach the truths to other people. So you're going to be a person who studies, a person who seeks to understand, well, what does that mean? What's the explanation of that particular verse? And seek to understand what its application is, and then be able to explain it to somebody else. I mean, for many of us, we had Bibles and we had wide margin Bibles, and we would write all these little notes in there that some of them we can still see, but some of them we can't, because we wrote so small that our eyes have worsened to the point where we really can't read those notes like we used to. But we would have them in there, because if somebody brought up a particular verse, then we could turn to that particular verse and then we could explain it. And sometimes we may not have known exactly what the verse was, but I remember knowing, okay, I know this verse is on in this section of the scriptures at this particular point on the page. So I could turn to the general area and then eventually turn to that passage and be able to maybe consult the note if needed and answer the question. So, you know, God has called us to be trained so that we are familiar with the scriptures. You know, it's not just the minister who explained it. That's his job, yes. But your job as a member of the church is to learn the answers too, where you're ready to explain to somebody, well, why do you keep the Sabbath? Why do you do this or that, or you don't eat this? And why do you go to these holy days? Can you explain those things? So you seek to dig into the scriptures, and you know what we would do is we would write down key points in our margins, in our Bible, so that information was there. And then you had your Bible with you. It was referred to as a sword, and you would get your sword out and open it up and be able to answer questions that came up. I know my wife's Bible was stuffed full of different notes and different pictures and things that she likes. So it's no longer flat. It kind of opens up at kind of a angle on both ends, because it's got a lot of information in there. But it's something that your Bible would be a tool, and you would be able to teach sound doctrine, teach the truths of God that have been passed down through the generations, and they're still the truths of God that we want to hold fast to. And our goal is to preserve them and to learn them and to pass them along so that other people can take those truths and they can pass them along to the next generation. So they go from one generation to the other. And these things that Paul has talked about so far, the seven desirable qualities that are to be found as in overseers, are crucially important to servants in the church being effective in the way that they serve the congregation. So we'll look at one other thing here, which will probably be all the time that we have this evening. But in 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 3, it talks about something different. He's been talking about those things that would lend to an individual being qualified to being a minister in the church. And then Paul talks about things that would disqualify a person from being a minister in the church. You might refer to them as four disqualifiers. And so in 1 Timothy 3:3, it says that an individual that is going to be an overseer should not be given to wine, should not be violent, should not be greedy for money, but gentle, not quarrelsome, not covetous. So he's talking about these qualities that would not lend themselves to a person being effective in the ministry. The first one he talks about is not given to wine or not given to drunkenness. So as you, throughout the Bible, it talks about not over drinking, but to drink only in moderation. And as you look throughout the scriptures give us multiple examples of people who are drunk, people who are caught up in drunkenness, which was a very common thing back in Paul's day. People, especially in the Roman and Greek world, regularly got drunk. And at different times in the history of the United States, drinking was a problem. And I think not only do you have a problem with drinking, but you have a problem with drugs in our day. And it tells us that we are not to be caught up in all of that. And especially somebody who's going to be a leader in the church, you can't be a person who has a problem with alcohol. You see a few scriptures that talk about these things in Luke chapter 21, verse 34, Jesus Christ says, "But take heed to yourselves, lest your hearts be weighed down with carousing, drunkenness, and cares of this life, and that day come on you unexpectedly." So you can become caught up in that lifestyle of drinking and partying and all of that, and the cares of this life, and then the coming of the kingdom is going to creep up on you, and you're not ready. In Galatians chapter 5, it says, he's speaking about the qualities that would disqualify you from being in the kingdom. And he speaks in beginning of verse 21 of envy, murders, drunkenness, revelries, and the like, which I tell you beforehand, just as I told you in times past, that those who practice such things will not inherit the kingdom of God. So there will be no drunks in the kingdom of God. There will be no people that have a problem with alcohol in the kingdom. So it is something that God is looking, and you think that he's bringing up that issue just for the fun of it? He's preparing people to serve in the kingdom of God. So he's not going to have you there as an overseer in his kingdom if you have a problem with alcohol or drugs or any other habitual practice that does not meet his standard. So just in summary, drunkenness has no place in the life of an overseer or any serious disciple of Jesus. So something that we have to all look at, how do we handle alcohol? Is it something that we handle properly, or is it a problem? Second, that the individual is not to be violent, but it goes on to say a little later on in the verses there, but he's not to be violent, but to be gentle. And when you look at being a servant in the church, or a member of the church even, it says, let your gentleness be known to all men. As it says in Philippians 4, verse 5, let your gentleness be known to all men. In 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 8, It says, finally, all of you be of one mind, having compassion for one another. Love as brothers, be tender-hearted, be courteous. So, you know, you can't be that way and be violent. You know, be angry, being attacking, being difficult to get along with. So these are qualities that he's looking at in people who will be leaders. When it talks about being gentle, sometimes that gives people the impression that being gentle, you're going to be a weak leader who blandly accepts whatever happens with a, you know, just a smile. You don't do anything. And as you think about that approach, neither Jesus Christ nor Paul are depicted that way in the New Testament. So Paul is calling for magnanimity that rules out quick-tempered, mercurial reactions, but to hear out, you know, basically to patiently hear out what people say. And even if what they say is critical or a slap in the face, to listen to it patiently, listen to it fully, and then make a wise decision about what's been said. But Paul does not mean as leaders that that we should just be a roll over and not stand up to people who confront us and challenge us. Like it says, we are to fight the good fight of faith. That's what it says in 1 Timothy 6, verse 22. He tells Timothy in 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 2, he tells Timothy to reprove. That means to correct people who are wrong, to rebuke and exhort. That is to encourage people to follow the right path. So all of those things, Paul is imparting to Timothy in order that Timothy is going to understand what his responsibilities are. So he's to be even-handed and measured in the way that he approaches the brethren in the church. He's to be gentle in dealing with the members. And finally, he's not to be greedy for money. You know, you have people that are very much caught up in making money. And, you know, I've known of people in the church who have taken advantage of people in the church and have seen them as a resource by which they can make money. And that's completely inappropriate. Completely inappropriate. And you know, somebody who's serving as an elder in the church, that should not be part of their conduct. In Hebrews chapter 13, verse 5, it says, let your conduct be without covetousness. Be content with such things as you have. For he himself has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. So if you're really intent on making money, my first word of advice is don't become a minister, because this is not where you make big money. That's going to have to be in some other job. Can you have enough to live on and be okay? You can, but this is not a big money job. So if you're going to become a minister for the money, you need to think again, because this is not where the money is. You need to look at the Willie Horton model, which somebody asked Willie why he robbed banks, and Willie said, because that's where the money is. And so the money is not something that you make oodles and boodles of in the ministry. And making money is not bad. If you're in a job that allows that, but you're not to take advantage of the members, not to use the members in any way, shape, or form to make money. And it's dangerous for people who are ministers in the church to be pursuing money. That's why if you noted that somebody has leadership ability, but they're really into making money, then you need to think twice about whether you would recommend them for ordination. So you want to be careful about that choice and look for people who have the qualities and integrity that is crucial to service in the church. So we'll stop there, and we'll pick up again after in the in uh, September, we'll pick up and we'll continue looking at 1 Timothy. We'll also look at some things that have to do with the upcoming Holy Days. So thank you all for joining this evening, and hopefully you've found it profitable. And I hope you'll go back and look at 1 Timothy 3 and see what the Apostle Paul was telling Timothy. And what he's doing is he's laying out for Timothy the fact that you're going to be pastoring the church here. And you need to have people that can help you, people that will be elders, people that will help you as overseers and as deacons and deaconesses. And you need to know how to choose those individuals that are going to be effective servants in helping you do the job. So he's basically telling Timothy, look, you're going to be here for the long haul. So you're going to have to get to know the people in the congregation and be able to enlist those people in the service of the congregation. And by your looking at the individuals based upon these qualities, then as you see those qualities, then you can make good choices that are going to be a blessing to the brethren and a blessing to the congregation as a whole. So hopefully that's been enlightening for you and will be helpful to you. And you know, we can all look at those qualities and see if they are present in our life. So thanks for your attention. We'll go ahead and end the study there.